It seems to me that the problem of loneliness is some sort of perennial problem that we have, and it's been going for a long time. If you look at back in history, de Tocqueville noticed in 1836 the loneliness of the Americans. I mean, this what we're talking about tonight is not new, a new topic, and we haven't got any solutions still.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we will be looking at the urgent and ubiquitous problem of social isolation. This growing epidemic, which is the root cause of many serious health problems, persists at a time when we are supposedly more digitally connected than ever before. Do Americans treat the issue seriously enough? And what steps can we take to alleviate loneliness in our own lives and in the lives of those around us? To help us examine several aspects about loneliness and friendship, we have the benefit of a panel of four great minds from four different disciplines. Dr. Terry Freiberg, a social psychologist and author of The Four Seasons of Loneliness. Dr. Amy Banks, a psychiatrist at Wellesley Centers for Women and author of Wired to Connect, The Surprising Link Between Brain Science and Strong, Healthy Relationships. Professor Sandy Pentland, who directs the MIT Connection Science and Human Dynamics Lab, and who's written a book entitled Social Physics, How Social Networks Can Make Us Smarter. And Princeton Professor of Philosophy, Alexander Nahamas, who has just published a book entitled On Friendship. So, let's kick off the questions with this question of chronic loneliness. Dr. Freiberg's research and Dr. Amy Banks, who interacts with patients all the time on this topic, what do you think are the causes of this and why is it getting worse?
Well, so we know a lot about the amount of chronic loneliness that's out there in this country. And from the year 2000 to the year 2012, it went from 20% to about 35% of the population. So there's about 44 million Americans who score as chronically lonely. That doesn't mean the everyday loneliness that we all feel when we suffer loss. Our grandparents die, then our parents die, our friends move, we lose mates and friends. Those things we all suffer, but we work through it. Chronically lonely people are a very different subset of people, and they don't work through it. And if you, just to be more direct then in the answer, Mary, to me there are three sort of variables that seem to me to cause this extraordinary uptick. The first is the loss of community. We've gone from, in pre-industrial society, up until the era of our great-grandparents, for sure, our grandparents, people lived in communities, and they were ethnic-based, they were religious-based, there were all sorts of bases, but they knew each other in a three-dimensional way in these communities. I'm a French-speaking person, I go back and forth to France a lot, and up to World War II, France was, over half of France was rural and small towns. So in those communities, people know each other in a very three-dimensional way, and that's not what happened once cities really grew and the Industrial Revolution pushed people together. We got to the point where people knew each other in just a superficial way or along one variable. So Jeffrey Dahmer, remember him? His neighbor says, hey, seemed like a perfectly nice guy to me. Remember the murderer. So the loss of community is to me one of the things that's pushing this ever-increasing amount of chronic loneliness. A second of the third would be the loss of connective ritual. I think throughout human history, as I understand it, there's been a lot of ritual available in cultures and subcultures where people really bonded with each other, knew, and had these culture norms that came and controlled them. And so they were able to find support systems. They couldn't get out of the support systems. That was one of the great punishments of medieval Europe was to be expelled from your town, because then you were outside of that kind of connectivity. And we have such wild geographic and even social mobility that many of us live far from our families. So we haven't just lost our community, we've lost our families. And finally, the nature of work in modern society seems to me to press this. It's such a hectic pace in urban life, rushing from place to place. Work is more de-skilled, it's more isolated, it's more insecure. Both parents work, And so the difference, you find some strong correlations between different societies when the mother works as well and out of the home. So those are three variables that seem to me to have pressed on the statistical presence of chronic loneliness to the point where it is definitely today a public health crisis.
And do you find this is the same with your patients coming into the practice?
For sure. Now, I have a self-selected group of people that actually come because they're either lonely, sad, depressed, anxious, you know, kind of they have the external manifestations of chronic loneliness in a sense. But, you know, I would put it at even a kind of larger brushstrokes. I think we have chronic loneliness because we actually have a society that breeds chronically lonely people. And what I mean by that, and what I really emphasize in my book, is the idea that in American culture, in American society, we are off the scales in this, what I would call a mythology of human development that says that our task, the ideal of a mature adult is one that moves towards ever-increasing levels of separation and individuation. And so what we're doing all the time is sending messages to our kids to stand on their own 2 feet, to develop self-regulation. It's all very self-oriented compared to anywhere else in the world. And when you do that, and so my work has been around the neuroscience, the neural pathways, if you will, that people need to have neurologically in order to interact in safe, healthy relationships and to build healthy relationships. And when you are pressuring kids all the time to compete, you know, to be the best on the soccer field, to be the best, the best, the best, you actually miss precious time for socialization and real social skills. And when you don't have those social skills, again, when you're separating your boys from their moms at age 4, then what's happening is you actually are disturbing, you're not growing the pathways for connection, and then they grow up very stressed, you know, in a whole other kind of realm where they don't necessarily have the same skills to make connections. And I think that is part of it. I think a lot of people wouldn't even know what a healthy relationship looks like, and how would you go about building one? That's before we even get to the extreme into loneliness.
Okay, Alexander.
If I may, I think we should not make the past so wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful to have community, of course, but think of a small town or a small village where everybody knows what everybody else is doing, and the kind of oppression, the kind of incredible control of individual people's lives that people had. So I think it's a question of the price that you have to pay. It's a question of getting something and losing something at the same time. Sure. I have a cartoon on my office door that has a bunch of ancient Greeks at a symposium lying down on their couches, and one of them turns to the other and says, "We used to have great men, Homer, Hesiod, Solon. Now what? Pipsqueaks, Plato, Socrates, Euripides." You know, we always look at the past in that way. And I think it's important to... the same thing with Putnam's book on bowling alone. Yeah, people... Of course, people are much more lonely today, but at the same time, they're not quite as oppressed by the community that they live in, and all their life is implicated.
Let's look at the topic of technology and the role it plays in this, because, of course, technology and digital communication is a fantastic tool, and it allows you to stay in touch with people thousands of miles away in an instant. But do you find that the actual constituents, the things that are necessary for quality friendships and relationships, are being jeopardized or marginalized by the use of technology? Alex, what does your research at MIT show on this, about the friendship between people and whether they have all these friends on Facebook?
Yeah, well, so the first thing that the research shows is that nothing replaces face-to-face communication. People live their lives with a tension, and the tension is between sort of exploiting the current environment, which is something you can do if you have strong reciprocal ties with people. You have people to work with, people to find solutions with, and exploring for new opportunities, which drives you outwards to experiment, but is destructive of the time you need for the reciprocal connections. And so, in many ways, our history has been, and history over dozens of decades, has been one of increasing ability to explore, but that puts increasing pressure on the support structure of society. It's in some ways a drive towards greater wealth, greater opportunity, but you only have so many hours in the day and so many things that you can, people you can talk to and so many exchanges you can do. And what we've built technology for mostly is to enhance that exploration, but not so much to enhance the reciprocal ties, the strong sort of core. And I think it's one of those things that the way our economic system is set up, it encourages, you know, clicks and new views and things like that, audience advertising, which pushes you out towards more exploration. So I think that a lot of the blame, if it were, falls to the fact that most of our media, including newspapers and things like that, are driven by advertising. Yeah. They want to reach as many people as possible. They want to be as sensational as possible. They want to drag you out of the personal relationships that they can't monetize.
Do you think that we had Sherry Turkle here last year talking about how empathy is starting to diminish, and even in teenagers, their lack of ability to read facial cues or body language because they don't do this face-to-face communication. And she said, oh, we have an app that people are going to download for that, an empathy app. So is this what we're heading towards, more and more technology and not confronting the problem with real fixes, which is people to talk to?
Well, the things that we've done, and we do these rather, some people think of it as rather appalling things, where we'll go into a community and under sort of as a medical research, convince everybody to be instrumented for a year. So we know, for instance, who they talk to, what they do on Facebook, what they buy, where they go. And rather than have them fill out surveys, we actually do these little electronic things.
Yeah.
And everybody knows it, and they get paid and all that sort of stuff. But what you see is you see that the notions of trust, the notions of empathy, are very strongly correlated with and predicted by strong reciprocal ties. Yeah. So what's a reciprocal tie? A reciprocal tie is something where I talk to you because there's something in it for me. I get value out of that. And you talk to me because you find me value too. So we have this mutually beneficial relationship for whatever reason.
Yep.
And so when you see that, that builds up trust. In fact, the definition of trust being expectation of future benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a way to sort of think about it. It's a very economics way to think about it. You may not like that. But if we have that sort of relationship, then I trust that you'll take my back, right?
Yep.
I trust because I provide that to you, so it's an exchange. As tools and environment pull us away from that, we're much more on the edge. We don't have anybody to watch our back.
Yeah.
Well, could we just go back to the issue of loneliness? And we talked a little bit, you talked about the chronic loneliness that's endemic now. How is that played out both health-wise in the individual? What are we suffering in ourselves as a result of loneliness? And then how does that play out in society? So maybe you could talk about the individual first, or maybe you could.
Yeah, I would say that the literature, the research on the health implications of chronic disconnection are amongst the most robust of any findings at all. And if you look at it through a biological perspective, because human beings are pack animals, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. We work best, literally. Our whole system works best when we are, you know, in those reciprocal relationships, what we would call it in my field, the mutual empathy, the win-win situations, and that's where our systems work the best. And it's not just, you know, that we're less anxious and less depressed. Our immune system, we're less stressed when we're in those relationships, and we know that there's a very clear link between the stress response and the immune response. So when you're chronically stressed because you're chronically disconnected, your immune system is impaired, literally you have less T cells. I mean, again, a whole bunch of literature, and you get sicker, not just with depression and anxiety, but with heart disease, with cancer. You know, right across the board, you're more susceptible to infection, right? And in fact, there was a famous recent study, you may know about this one, where they literally had people come in and get cuts in their skin, and followed their healing capacity when they were with somebody that they felt that they were in a, again, reciprocal or empathic connected relationship with, and they healed more quickly. Mm. So that is just huge.
So to put it another way, that perhaps is even stronger. So we've shown in various communities by these sort of very dense monitoring that in fact the other way around works. Is when you see a degradation in social relationships, that's a very reliable cue that the person is suffering from some sort of problem, either physical or mental. And in fact, Kaiser Permanente, a big health care, uses that actually to monitor their chronic patients. So what they do is they put a little bit of software that we developed on the phone, and when the person's behavior, when their integration with the rest of society changes, the nurse gives them a call. Mm. Yep. Says, what's up? Yep. Because almost always, something's wrong. Every once in a while, they call up and the person says, I'm writing the great American novel. Right. But that's the rare one, right? Right. Right.
And another way to put the same point is that social isolation is as great an indicator of morbidity and mortality as high blood pressure, obesity, a very sedentary lifestyle, and a lot of smoking. That's how unhealthy it is.
Right. And what sort of crimes or people have you had to assist as an attorney in relation to the loneliness playing out in violent acts or whatever else people do when they're very lonely?
The cases I've had, I'm not a criminal attorney, so it's not that I've represented people who've committed or allegedly committed criminal acts, because you know, and mm-hmm. one could say that their loneliness took part in it. I'm more on the civil side of law and watching what happens in lives, in whole lives, to people who are quite isolated and don't have this kind of connectivity that my colleagues are talking about, which is so self-preservative and so important for health. And so they drowned. Just as you drowned overboard in the ocean after a while, I suppose someone over the side of a ship after a while stops paddling around and goes under the waves, they go under the social waves. They don't survive.
So I think there's a mythology in Western culture about people being individuals, right, and being, you know, standing alone, independent, things like that. But when we look at these sort of communities, we find that it's the interactions between people that predict behaviors far more than their individual beliefs. In fact, the strong version of this is that all of our beliefs are things to justify what we actually did. Mm-hmm. So they're all post hoc. So if you want to ask about people's diet, if you want to talk about violence and things like that, if you look at the people around them, that's an extraordinarily strong predictor of what they'll do too. What that points to is the way we learn norms, the way we learn how to behave, is by observation and interaction with people around us. And it's amazingly strong. You may think you have very strong convictions, but for most people, if I put you in a place where everybody else has different convictions, you will change. And you'll make up a reason why you changed, but you'll begin changing. So for instance, for people that are isolated, they've become unanchored. They have no good way to know what are the norms of behavior. They don't know what to ignore. They don't know what to pay attention to because they can't check it with other people. That's our basic mechanism of understanding the world, is validating things with other people.
Do we know anything about the causality, the causal mechanism that correlates, for example, having mutual friendships with better health, or with the other factors that you mentioned before? Is it, for example, something that happens because you heal faster, you said, for example, right? But is that because there are two of you or more and two people are looking at the wound?
You know that particularly with mental disease, changing the social situation is enormously effective for early stages, not for really radically unbalanced. Maybe you disagree with that or agree with that.
No.
But as an intervention for, say, depression, early stage, get out, talk to people, get some friends.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you all very much. If people would like to come up and pose questions, feel free.
It seems to me that the problem of loneliness is some sort of perennial problem that we have, and that's been going for a long time. If you look at back in history, de Tocqueville noticed in 1836 the loneliness of the Americans. Reisman wrote The Lonely Crowd in 1950. Habits of the Heart was written in 1985 by Bella and company. Eleanor Rigby. I mean, this, what we're talking about tonight is not new, a new topic, and we haven't got any solutions still. So I just wanted to sort of bring this up. It seems to me this is very interesting. Everything that you said was very interesting, but we don't have a solution, and we're still talking about this problem. So let me just finish by saying that it seems to me that, aside from the fact that I think it's hopeless because I think there are just too many people, that we should by now not have ideas of individuality, but we should have some sort of sociosophy. We should have some sort of wisdom of community, wisdom of society. By 2016, we should have something more than what we've got, which is interesting contributions that you've made, but they're just little pieces of something. We really haven't progressed very much as far as I see it on this topic.
Well, not to be unpopular, but the Ivy Leagues have a wisdom about this, which you can fight with, and I'm not going to defend. And if you look at the people they admit and the values that they have, one of the very primary ones is people who form teams and act as teams, typically sports teams, clubs, things like that. Historically, that has been as important as your grades. It's still as important as your grades. I have kids that are getting into colleges now, and it's a little galling for them because they're trying to get all A's, and the person who's like really good at lacrosse or something is getting recruited because they're good at lacrosse. So, what was that? Well, it's because the colleges have decided that some of these activities are somehow intrinsically valuable, and I think that if you look at the people on the teams, that notions like loneliness are de minimis there. Other problems, I'm not going to defend it, but I'm going to say that that's at least one version of conventional wisdom about it.
Well, you know, what I want to say in relation to what you're saying is that I really do think that, you know, there are places in the world where loneliness isn't as dramatic as it is here, right? And when you look at countries that are measuring things on a happiness scale rather than a money scale, it's different. You begin the value system here. You know, I've often wondered, because I've been with a group that really has been talking about nothing but the centrality of relationships in people's lives for the past 40 years. And what's always amazing to me is the resonance with people, anybody that we speak to, male, female, rich, poor, black, white, everybody can sit there and nod their heads and, yeah, I get that, and that makes sense, and then it dissipates. It's amazing. You walk out of the room, the people scatter, and it dissipates. And, you know, maybe this is naive of me, but I think it butts up against this larger notion of individualism. Yeah. We are off the scales with individualism. And, you know, I'm sure there is some biochemistry around social exclusion. There's research around oxytocin that, you know, this great hormone that everybody thought was neuroaffiliative, meaning that if you had oxytocin, then you were going to reach out and grab your neighbors and every kumbaya. And, you know, what they find out is after a certain level of it, what happens is you kumbaya with your neighbors, but then you start excluding others. So there's some biology in here about social exclusion, right? And, you know, how many people should be in the tribe or the community. But when you have a system that is from day one in every kind of piece of information and everything you breathe telling you that you're better and stronger standing on your own, it really undermines everything we're trying to do. And so I think we have to look not actually in our country for answers to this, because I don't think we're going to get it. You know, I don't think we're going to get it in our country.
So what's really popular with my friends now, my peers, is this thing called Finsta, which is a fake Instagram. You may or may not have heard of it. So Instagram is social media. It's like a blog. I follow you, you follow me. We can see each other's pictures. But what a Finsta is basically another blog created by the same user and who just follows their really close friends. And it's a place to like rant and say like, oh, I really hate this girl in my English class. She was so annoying today, which is obviously cyberbullying, but other things like, oh, like life really is bad right now. So my question is this popularity of a close friend social media thing, is it a move toward more tied friendships, and I don't want every single one of my friends to see this or to see that side of me? Or is it unhealthy that we're ranting to a screen and not to other people?
Mm. Good question.
Can I ask a qualifying question? So the concept of it is, and I just heard about this the other day, my daughter's 18 as well, and I had said something about, oh, you're doing an Instagram, and she's like, oh, nobody does that anymore, right? They do, what is it called, Finsta? Finsta.
Instagram.
Fake Instagram.
Yeah.
And so are you saying that the group that goes out to is smaller and more intimate?
Yes,
okay.
Very much so.
Okay. See, it may be just that I'm an introvert, but I'm all for smaller and more intimate.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's something about the expressiveness that you talk about, right?
You miss that.
You what?
Yeah, you will miss that.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So it feels to me like a step forward, but keep actually ranting to your friends. Keep doing it in real time too.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's complicated because usually the way these things work is you use tools like that in conjunction with physical relationships. You see them at school, you talk to them, you know who they are. You know them because you have this sort of rich perception of them in situations. You see the relationships. And then the digital things come along and augment that or nuance that. In various
ways. Telephone used to do that until we had that, right? I mean, it's the cliche of the
teenager. Or
closing his or her room, talking to them on the telephone for the whole
or
letters. Or passing notes in class.
Right, right.
All those things were that way, but obviously you can carry it too far, right? And you can use it in bad ways. And I don't know, I think it's really complicated. The part that's really, I find disturbing is when people develop a dialogue about their life that's divorced from reality. And when you have a very tight conversation like that dominates your thinking, you can go off the deep end in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
People will believe stupid things regularly if their friends are believing it too. You know the famous saying, you know, your mom says to you, if your friends jumped off the bridge, would you too?
Mm-hmm.
And generally the answer is yes.
Yes.
And actually, generally, that's a good thing. Because if all your friends are doing it, probably it looks stupid, but it's probably right. But sometimes they're wrong, and that's a disaster. Yeah, so it's complicated, unfortunately.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Loneliness in the Digital Age, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in December 2016. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. The ancients believed that friendship bound the universe together. We hope they are right. Thank you for joining us, and do come again.